History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And no, they don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we end up educated, we're always entertained, and so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We've come to the end of 2025, and maybe you're starting to take stock of the things you experienced this year. I'm so thankful for all the amazing veterans we met around the country in 2025, and look forward to meeting so many more in 2026. As we close out this year, we're going to dedicate today's program to a couple of veterans who just hit the century mark, as well as some special vets who finished their earthly journeys just ahead of the end of the year. I want to wish a happy 100th birthday to David Fusinato, a World War II Marine who was born December 27th, 1925. We're going to hear some of his Okinawa story in a bit, and also tell you where you can find Dave every week since he's still volunteering. For him, the Christmas cheer rolls right into his centennial celebration in California, but on the opposite coast, 3 days before the start of Hanukkah, one of the more than half a million Jewish American veterans of World War II hit the century mark in New York City. So we also get to salute Arthur Grabiner for birthday number 100.
I was at home. It was a Sunday. Country what they write. It was a nice sunny day in New York City. I was in my bedroom. I had my radio, and I was listening to the football game, the New York Giants versus the Dodgers. And while listening to the game, all of a sudden, there was an announcement, all military personnel, please report back to your base. I don't know what the heck's going on. I'm listening here. Later on, they said a Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. If you asked me where Pearl Harbor was, I did not know it. If you showed me a map, I couldn't think. The next day, in our high school, we all reported to our homeroom, and the PA system was on, and we heard the President Roosevelt ask for a declaration of war against Germany, Italy, and the Japanese. And life from that moment on changed for me, for everybody in the country. We had ration stamps, growing up buying war bonds and everything. Women went to work, and it was the surcharge at night, the test, blackouts and everything. If you saw a Western Union messenger, those days, the Western Union messenger was on a bike. He had a khaki uniform. You saw him in your neighborhood. That was bad news because the War Department sent a telegram to the next of kin telling him your loved son, daughter, whatever, was killed. And that was terrible to see that.
And I'm curious, too, because being right here in New York City, you're close to some things that a lot of people don't think of when it comes to World War II. I mean, we think about the European theater and the Pacific, but the U-boat threat off the Atlantic coast, is that something you were aware of at the time?
We were aware. At that time, not everybody had a radio, no televisions. What it was, there were sinking ships right off New York constantly, and they would go with a newspaper, extra, 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 and you buy a paper for 3 cents. That's how you got everything. You went to movies. There was Movie Tone News, which came on and showed this occupation that we were doing. Things weren't going good for us at the beginning. They would sink on our ships, but we were building. For every ship they sunk, we built two to replace them. And we were well aware of the war. in New York City. Now, there was rationing. My brother had a car, couldn't get gasoline. He had to sell his car.
I want to ask also, because I know that, you're one of the many Jewish American veterans who served in World War II. Were you aware, was your family aware of what was happening to the Jewish people throughout Europe because of the Third Reich?
Yes. Well, later on, we were aware that they were confiscating all the goods of the Jewish people in Germany, Italy, and we were aware of it. My grandmother came from Poland, was fleeing the Nazis, and she passed away. In the Jewish religion, you sit for a week, what they call sitting shiva. You sit on a cardboard box, and my mother, some relative came and found out that my grandmother was killed, and my mother sat for a week. There are dietary restrictions in Jewish. The Arabs, the Palestinians have the same thing. You don't meet with dairy. I get up to Samson, New York, 7 o'clock in the morning. My first meal in the Navy was a bologna sandwich on white bread. That's meat, and the bread is made with milk, with a glass of milk. Welcome to the U.S. Navy.
Nothing kosher about it.
No. But I bent all the rules there were. I stood 4-hour watch every day of the week, January 12th at night to 4 in the morning, as if I was on a bridge listening to the officer tell me 40 knots, 20 knots, whatever it was, and I related down to the engine room. And when we had general quarters, I was talking near a gun, a 40-millimeter gun. Later on, we had the loading up our passengers, I'll call them. They went over the side on a rope ladder into the land. Well, I was there. I had a big pole with a flag. And what it was, we're out a couple of miles from the beach. They go in a circle. I wave my flag, and they come, hook up. And then they go, now, very good, they go in there, but there's one problem. Many instances, they can't hit the beach. There's coral, rock, and everything. Well, they drop the ramp back further and all the Marines or the Army personnel at the time, they would go in, hands over the head, with carrying the rifle, the water up to the belly button, the backpack with the ammunition that it's kept dry. Now, they hit the beach. Even though we had a beach party to greet them, and on our ship, let me go back, we had two surgeons in sick bay, a general practitioner, a dentist, and a chaplain. They sent us six wounded servicemen, and our crew took care of him. Eventually, we went to Saipan, and we dropped him off. But the Japanese lulled our troops in. It was quiet. Then they get in, and they're in tunnels, and they came out, and hellfire blew open. But here, the beach, fine. They get back here in the trees and everything. That's when they engaged the enemy.
What was the first battle you were involved in?
Lingayen Gulf in the Philippines. We were there for one day. We got rid of our troops. Now, en route to the Philippines, the head medical officer called me and he wanted to speak to me. I go in, what's the situation? Of the 550 crew members, I'm the only one that had AB blood, which is a rare type of blood. And he suggested that I give a pint of blood and they would keep it in reserve for me. I said, fine, my brother. So let's go. That blood stood in the refrigerator till the ship was decommissioned. I was thankful, lucky I didn't have to use it. Navy life was good to me. I enjoyed it.
People from all over the world have met you on the aircraft carrier, the Intrepid, there. Why do you do that? Why is that so important to you?
Well, no one, it's exhilarating. And number two, while I'm alive, we'll try to pass on the gospel truth. They write different things. They leave everything out. This is my hands-on experience. Went to fifth grade school to teach some students. I'm talking about an honor flight, and I said, we went to an honor flight and came back, and they were greeting us and everything. And all of a sudden, kids said, hey, I was on that group that greeted you. And the other side said, I was there too with my baseball team. Small world.
And you mentioned the honor flight. So we've heard from a lot of veterans on this program who've been on the honor flight from all over the country. What was the experience like for you, and what were the elements of it that really stood out?
When I went to Washington and they had displays, the Pacific Theater War, European War. My interest was in the Pacific Theater, and one of my grandchildren was going to college in Washington, and we had to meet us there in the airport. Now, I took him and I pointed out, we were here, we were there, this is where we dropped bombs, etc., and everything. It brought back memories.
And I'm just curious, I'm always interested in this, when a World War II veteran goes there to the World War II Memorial, which was such a long time coming, which took $197 million of World War II veterans' money to build. You mentioned the European and Pacific, and there's the fountain, but behind that fountain, there's that wall of gold stars. Representing over 400,000 Americans, guys like you, who didn't get to come home. When you were looking at those stars, is there a thought or idea that went through your mind?
During the war, there were 16 million Americans who were in the military. As you mentioned, 400,000 were killed. 600,000 were wounded. You see these with artificial legs, etc. It brings back some bad memories of the war.
You told us some of the things you went through. Ships getting hit right next to you, kamikazes in the air. Did you ever feel like someone was protecting you?
No, I thought we all on our ship, we all were of the same mind. We were fearless, and nothing's going to happen to us.
Arthur Grabiner of Queens, New York, now 100 years old. We'll hear what another freshly minted centenarian went through with the Marines on Okinawa when this special year-end edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up 2025 by wishing a happy 100th birthday to two of our previous guests on opposite coasts. We heard from Arthur Grabiner of Queens, New York, but way out in California, David Fusinato hits the century mark this weekend. He still drives himself to the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, in Fresno every week to serve as a volunteer docent. That's actually where we first interviewed him 15 years ago, in 2010. Way back when he was 20, Dave was with the 1st Marine Division's 1st Tank Battalion on Okinawa.
Yeah, I felt pretty secure till we took a hit on top of the turret. And it jarred everybody in the tank, but fortunately, nobody was really seriously wounded or got a lot of bruises and stuff, but outside of that, why, everybody was okay.
Is that something you have any kind of warning of? Do you see,
We think it was a mortar hit the top of the tank.
What did it feel like?
It jarred everybody inside the tank.
Did you leave your feet?
No, I was, because if I left my feet, I would bump my head on the inside top of the turret.
But it gave you a little shaking.
Oh, yes, shook everybody up.
Was that the only time you got hit?
That's the only time we got hit by anything big. We took a lot of small arms fire. Any tank weapons didn't hit our tank in particular, but the tanks around us got hit by any tank weapons. And the Japanese had a good one, too, a 47 millimeter.
What did you see happen to those tanks that got hit by that?
Well, most of them survived. It took a hit in the side and penetrated the tank, but it didn't do any damage on the inside of the tank. I believe one of them had the tracks knocked off of it by an explosive, but the crew got out and got back to off the front line, so they were okay. One of our platoon tanks, it wasn't the platoon I was in, they got hit one time, and I believe the gunner was killed, and the driver was seriously wounded. That was out of our company. Now, the other companies, I really don't know. I really can't say anything about them.
So you knew, though, what could possibly happen to you guys. That was always out there.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Now, when you were the loader and handling the radio, how much visual contact did you have outside the tank? Did you have any idea where you were going, or are you pretty much blind?
Because every hatch had a periscope. You could see exactly where you were going, and you can turn the periscope around with 360 degrees, so you can see pretty much where you are in the area and any enemy coming towards you. As a gunner, you have a telescopic sight.
That was my question. Once you became a gunner, did that kind of give you a different view of the whole war?
A very, very different view. Yeah, you had your telescopic sight, plus you had your, which you could see all over. Close up. It was a lot different than being a loader, I tell you.
I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of some of our audience members, and there are probably a lot of people that haven't heard us talk too much about tanks before. But in your tank group on Okinawa, the tanks that you're in, how many men to a crew? How many guys are inside that tank?
A 5-man crew.
And so you at first were the loader, then you end up the gunner. And are you making the decision to fire that gun, or is someone making it for you?
No, tank commander is making the decisions. Where to point the gun and when to fire.
There's not a lot of you having to react necessarily to what you see. You just have to hear the command.
Yeah, but once I pick out a target with the telescopic sight, I can tell the tank commander through the intercom radio I have a target in sight, and then he'll look at it with it maybe his binoculars or through the periscope or something, and then say fire away.
And what kind of targets are you firing upon?
Caves mostly. And if we can find an open cave, then we open fire on it. And sometimes you can't see anything at all along the ridges. And a lot of times the infantry alongside of us picks out a target. They phone the tank commander, and the tank commander gives a message to the gunner just about exactly where it's at. I forgot to tell you, alongside the big gun, there's a 30 caliber that's coaxed to the big gun. And you fire the 30 caliber, and it's got tracers, every third bullet, fourth bullet. And so you can pick out the target exactly. And the tank commander says, yeah, you're right on it, so fire away. So then you fire the small gun first, pick out your target, and then fire the big gun.
Was it any different doing that in actual combat than it had been in training?
Yeah, a lot different, yes, very different.
Was it harder?
Yes, it was, yeah. During training, while you're rolling along, and they fire at that dummy tank out there, and so you fire away and hope you hit it. But in combat, no, it's a lot different, yeah. No comparison.
You talked about waiting nearly a month to actually get in the action while you're in reserve there. On the island. Now, once you're actually in action, How long did that go? Did you go in spurts of 10, 15 minutes at a time? Did you feel like it was the whole day through going nonstop? What was that like for you as far as how intense and how engaged you were?
When you go in the front lines, it's all day, from daylight till dark. We couldn't keep our tanks on the front lines after dark. We'd have to pull back to the tank area, refueling, re-ammo, get ready for the next day. Clean the guns, get ready for the next day action. So every night we'd pull off the lines, leave the infantry out there all by themselves. Really felt sorry for them, but nothing we could do, and that's the way we operated.
How exhausting was that to be on and have the pressure on and be really fighting for your life from daybreak till sunset?
Well, I don't know. I guess you kind of get immune to it, you know, kind of numb. We set up machine gun nests all around the perimeter of the tank park and stand guard most of the night. 4 or 5 hours anyway. And luckily, you get 3 or 4 hours sleep before you had to get up and go back into the front lines again.
Is it fair to say that could be more agonizing than what you're doing during the day? Because you can't see anything? You don't know when something's going to happen?
Yeah, it's just pretty scary at night there, especially when they send the flares up and the flares come down and you see all these shadows out there in the distance. And you don't know if the enemy is moving out there towards you or if it's just shadows from the flare coming down and moving tree branches and trees. And so it's pretty scary at night.
Was there anything that kind of kept you going, kept you focused, kept you determined to make it through another day? Because it seems like when you do this day after day, it could really drain you and kind of wear on you.
I don't know. I guess we did the best we could. We had to do it, and we had a job to do, and somehow we got through a day today.
Did you ever have guys with you that you kind of had to give a pep talk to, or vice versa?
You mean we had guys that we called it Asiatic, like battle fatigue. We had a couple guys that kind of broke down, sure.
I imagine that doesn't make things any easier for you.
No. You think about that, you know. It's on your mind constantly, but we just had to keep going, that's all.
I imagine there had to be some times there where it felt like it was never going to end.
Exactly. A very serious situation, a very devastating combat is something you can't explain. It's just unbelievable.
I know when you're in the middle of it, it's very difficult to see the big picture and have a grasp of what's happening around you. But did it get to a point where you started to see signs of victory on its way, of the battle nearing its end?
With the Battle of Okinawa, once we took the Shuri line, the Japanese moved as far south as they could. They were near the southern tip of the island. And so we knew that, you know, it was just a matter of time where we'd win the battle, or I should say secure the island, exactly, yes.
In all those days of combat and staring through that periscope and firing away and seeing everything that was happening around you, are there any things that you saw or witnessed that really stand out that left the biggest impression on you?
Yeah, one day was pretty scary. We had three tanks in a column, and we were headed to the front lines, and we were warned about suicide soldiers, Japanese soldiers. They would carry what we call satchel charges, and they would hide alongside of the road in their spider holes or whatever. And as a tank came along, they would run out and throw the satchel charge in the tracks of the tank. Well, the satchel charge would explode, blow the tracks off the tank. And one day we were going up to the front lines, and I saw one of those little buggers come off the side of the road there, and he had a satchel charge in his hand, and he threw it at the tank. Luckily, it bounced off the tank, the side of the tank, and in the meantime, our middle tank shot him. And so that was a pretty scary moment. We were waiting for the big explosion.
And he threw it at your tank or a tank in front of you?
No, it was the middle tank. The middle tank took the hit. But luckily it bounced off the tank. So, but that was probably the worst that I actually saw. We knew probably the invasion of Japan would be coming up next, but we didn't know too much about that either until we set up camp and started training for the invasion of Japan.
Now, one thing I didn't ask you about with regard to the actual battle on Okinawa, and this was the first battle that you were involved in, so it was the only real taste of this you had. Did the sheer volume of casualties ever get to you? I mean, was that ever something that became an intimidating or imposing thought in your mind to see how many of your fellow Marines were dying there?
We knew we suffered heavy casualties, but we never knew the figures until later on, actually till after the war, after VJ Day. And then we realized, you know, how devastating that battle was.
So it was probably a good thing you didn't know the numbers at the time.
Exactly.
So the battle is complete. The island is secure. But you guys aren't leaving the island. You just moved a little bit.
Moved up to the north end of the island, set up a new camp, and started training for the invasion of Japan, which was taking place in the fall of 45.
And none of you have ever heard of an atomic bomb. There's no reason to think that invasion won't happen.
Exactly. The atomic bomb was all new to us.
What kinds of things had you heard about what to expect on mainland Japan? Did you have any reason to believe it would be any different than what you'd experienced there?
Worse.
Why was it going to be worse?
Well, I believe all the Japanese civilians were armed and ready for us. And besides that, the Japanese had a lot of weapons left, a lot of suicide weapons left, like suicide submarines. Of course, they had the kamikaze airplanes. They must have had hundreds of those stowed away somewhere. Any method at all of it where they could kill a lot of Americans by that.
I'm sure you've heard the estimates, the official government military estimates at the time were that an invasion of mainland Japan would cost at the least 1 million American lives, not to mention what would happen on the Japanese side and who knew how long this would go on. Is there much doubt in your mind that you would have been part of that 1 million, that your name would have been on that list had the bomb not been dropped?
I believe that the bomb saved my life, just like it did thousands of Pacific veterans. Yeah, I really do believe, and I thank old Harry Truman and everybody that was responsible for dropping a bomb.
When did you hear about it? And what was the buzz around where you were?
We heard about the first bomb, I guess it was the next day in the morning in the mess hall, it was announced.
Do you remember how that announcement came out?
Everybody was green. They didn't know anything about atomic energy. Very few. The college guys knew something about it, but...
Well, I'm just curious, because this has to be something none of you guys have ever heard of before, and I'm curious, you know, how everybody reacted to that news. Was there instant celebration? Was there confusion?
Yeah, there was a lot of confusion, because nobody knew anything about the bomb, about atomic energy. We learned in a hurry all about it, and how devastating that bomb was, and then, of course, when they dropped the second one, well, we figured it was just a matter of time till the Japanese finally surrendered.
Do you remember about where you were when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered and what that meant to you and the guys who were around you?
Oh, we were combat training to hit the island of Japan. It was great. I think they gave us 2 beers that day. I can't remember, but I think it was like a couple of beers to celebrate.
When you look back now, and I know you work at the Veterans Memorial Museum as a volunteer docent, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, that gives you the opportunity to come in contact with a lot of young people who come through, a lot of people who have questions about World War II. What's the number one message that you try to get through to them as far as what the significance of World War II is in today's world? Why is it important for you to keep that history alive? What's important for us to remember today?
I think World War II history is very important for people to learn or to know more about, especially school kids.
Now 100-year-old Marine David Fusinato. If you're ever passing through Fresno, California, find him volunteering at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, we'll remember two more World War II veterans who left us just before year's end. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank, so the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, closing out 2025 by honoring two of our World War II vets who just turned 100, and now a couple whose earthly journeys came to an end here in the final month of 2025. Joe Reyes passed away 3 days before Christmas, just about 6 weeks shy of his 102nd birthday. He survived some pretty close calls with the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery in Europe during World War II.
I was going up on the beach in Omaha with the half-tracks. You know, the Corps has to pick up all the dead bodies, and according to their tags, they're identified. We saw bodies still floating. It was something that you just can't bring it into mind. It's you can't say it's horrible. It's worse than that. The boys that survived that invasion, I don't think they'll ever be the same again. Their eyes, what they saw, what they felt. It's, you can't explain what your eyes saw. It's to hell and back. That's what it is. It's the only way you can describe it, you know, to hell and back. I don't know if I can answer anymore.
Well, so you're seeing all this evidence of what's happened in the preceding days, and none of that's very encouraging, but then you're going to be fired upon as well. What was the first instance of that you experienced? What was the first hazard or danger to yourself that you realized?
Shoot them before they shoot me. Survive. You keep your wits and operate your guns properly, and don't be afraid. If you're afraid, don't show it. Just hide it and do your job, or else you're not going to be around. They're going to kill your position. So you don't even think about that. You're operating that gun and boom, 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 bang. And so not only my half-track, but the other half-tracks get them before they get me. That was a motto we had to do. We didn't even, when you're operating that gun, you don't think about dying. You only think about making accurate to make sure you knock down the planes. That was our motto.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. So you're the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. So your job is to shoot down planes. What was the first opportunity you had to do that? What was the first time you encountered enemy planes?
Well, we encountered them when our supplies were coming on board. We were positioned inland already. We had columns of material providing the war, guns, tanks, quartermaster. You know, they carry the food and all of that. And we'd be right there on besides the side of the road, all strung out. The whole battalion strung out like that, give them air cover. Sometimes we got them, and sometimes some of them was bound to sneak in, and the bay battery would get the most of it because they were way up ahead. But we made sure we stay alive by being accurate. If the planes were too far, we would shoot a barrage. And they never make it. The intense of that barrage was like 4th of July. They knew they couldn't get to that barrage, so they come down low, right beside your gun position, you couldn't fire. You know, and then way over there, they come up.
And so these would be Messerschmitt 109s or the FW-190s who are diving and strafing you guys?
Messerschmitts and the Stuka and the Wolf. They had a bomber, and then they didn't try to bomb us. They just go right down, and you can shoot at them. Our barrage was so intense. I mean, to tell you, they get hit before they even get to the target. We instead of using my scope for the distance, just fire out there, try and get as close as you can to him because he's about 2 miles out and he's out of range on your mill screen. So you just fire above him and ahead of him. He's so far out, but still you can still get a hit. You get a still barrage, you're still effective.
So what you guys were doing, because of the strength of how many anti-aircraft guns you had, you were creating a wall of flak that they would have to fly through?
That's it, a wall of fire. And it was difficult for them to get through it. And they were getting hit. Well, like I said, they just died, and you couldn't fire at them. They go by and they would wave, especially the ones on the bombers. They turn around there, you could see their face, and they wave like this, you know, give out the old salute. And we go like this.
You give them the one-finger salute?
One-finger story. All of a sudden, there was a ping, cling, 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 and the doggone bullet came around inside of the half-track, you know. Well, a sniper, the reason that bullet was going that way, because it hit the barrel of the gun on the very edge of the barrel, and I was right behind it. He missed me because he hit the barrel of the gun with maybe that much.
So you were less than an inch away from getting hit by that sniper's bullet.
And then I heard an infantryman say, "We'll get him." You know, the infantry coming up. It was already dusk. And he said, "We'll get him." I heard him say that.
So you're sitting in the half track behind the barrel of that gun. They shoot right at the barrel. It glances off the side and ricochets all throughout your half track, but never hits you.
I never did find that. I wanted to find that ricocheting bullet and never did find it. You know, I would have taken it as a memoir, you know. Well, my heart went boom, 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 man, you know. And, well, he missed me. It was a good thing. He would have hit me right here.
Right in the heart?
Yes, right above the heart, it would have hit me. I still think the barrel of that gun was in the way that it ricocheted off.
The late Joe Reyes, now reunited above with his late wife, Gloria. And finally today, we get to honor another centenarian who just left us. Bob McAvoy will be laid to rest December 30th. The Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania native lied about his age to get into World War II.
After the December 7th thing, and the next day, I guess I started thinking about it, and also them said, go to the Navy. I wanted to join the Navy and let it ride around on the ships.
Well, let's talk about that. Why not the Army or the Marines or anything else? Why the Navy?
Because I was so skinny and slow and small in stature. I didn't develop muscles or anything like that. And I thought to myself, going in the Army, they got a lot of gear they got to carry around. In fact, that was a mistake on my part because, like, getting off to the side. at the training camp when I went in the Navy. Was up in Newport, Rhode Island in December, in cold. Rhode Island's out of on the East Ocean, Atlantic Ocean. December, colder than H-E-double-L. And it was a riot. There were, I don't know how many, but we were only there 2 weeks. That's the emergency, going through it to get you in there and tell you what to do and get the heck out and get in action. So it was only 2 weeks spent at it, but the only thing we did was march. We learned how to march together, and we had wooden rifles that we carried around with us, and we'd do all that things, you know, that the Marines do, like a bam. Those guys are something else. That's when we came down to South Boston. After 2 weeks, took us down there, put us aboard the USS San Diego, which was commissioned in January the 10th, 1942. We got stored up and everything, and I don't know what the date was when we left there, but when we left, our first cruise was up to East Coast, and we went north up to Maine. We went into Portland, Maine. We anchored out there for a night or so, but it was so beautiful up there. There are small islands all around Portland, and it's just fantastic views. And my head was going right there. I really enjoyed it, you know. And I'll never forget my first step when you get out onto the ocean. We turned out of the harbor and start going north. The sea was pretty calm, except it was wavy. Huge waves, but they were soft. But the ship was going up and down like this. And I'm out there on the deck, and the first step I take, the ship goes out from under me, and I go, woo! Holy macaroni, did I get my sea legs in a hurry. And I just kind of concentrated on that. Pretty soon it just grew on me. The first thing I know, we're out to sea. We stopped in Pearl Harbor. Oil all over the harbor from the all the ships that the December 7th attack. Oh, it was terrible-looking stuff. And smelled, but we got everything fixed up there, and then the next thing I know, we're going out with the Hornet. And what I failed to tell you about was that the San Diego was one of four anti-aircraft cruisers that were built the same time, I guess. The San Diego, the San Juan, the Atlanta, and the Juno. The Juno was the poorest one, because when she engaged around Guadalcanal, she got sunk in I don't know how many minutes, but almost the whole crew got lost on the darn thing. And right away, all those four ships were changed. No surface engagements. All were anti-aircraft and mostly assigned to carriers, because they're the ones that needed our protection to get some stuff in the air so that the Japs can't get at the carriers. So I get back to where we get into the South Pacific. The Hornet was our first ship that we protected. We were assigned to them for protection. I'm sitting in the seventh turret on the second from the last on the back of the ship. And I was going for gunner's mate because I had been assigned to that turret. I was called the trainer, which I moved the turret in a horizontal position. And the guy on the other side, it was called the pointer, and he controlled the turrets in the up and down side. And then we had, of course, the captain of the turret, first class gunner's mate. He was in charge. I don't know many advertisers. McAvoy, you're going the wrong way. I said, holy McAvoy, I'd have to turn back. I didn't do any of them. When he tests, I go, whoa, it scared the hell out of me. So I was, man, I just wore my arms up. I was turning out like a steam engine, you know, because I realized what it meant to me. We got to do this fast. There's an alert on. That means there may probably planes in the air, Japanese planes. So you got to be on the line. And he was just doing his duty. he's hollered like it in. My hair went up in the air like that. I thought, oh, well, I'm going the wrong way. But that didn't happen very often after that, boy. I had to make sure I was going the right way. Port of starboard. You get out there and then just turn the switch, and that's all I had to do. Which was very hard. But what I was leading up to, the first thing of the war meant to me, we were out with the Hornet. We were cruising along in a group around the Guadalcanal area at the start of the war. I'm sitting on the outside my turret. It's just a sunny day, beautiful weather. We're cruising along at 30 knots because the guy in charge of the admiral or something, he was known for his speed of staying at 30 knots, because that's hard for a submarine to get at you. But anyway, that's what happened. I'm sitting there, and it's the steering room, so I'm looking at the where we've been, where we're cruising along. The second in command on the ship, it was your lieutenant commander, and I forget what his name was. He was out walking, and he was on there on the starboard side, aft of the ship, just out walking. We weren't in any emergency situation. I'm looking at him, and I see him, and I see nothing's going on. But all of a sudden, I look past him, which my eyes went by him, and I looked out, and there's bubbles coming towards me. I looked, oh, my God, it's a torpedo, and damn it. he looked, I guess he was watching, he saw it too. He turned around and went, zoom, going up the side of the ship. And I looked at that, and I watched that thing. You know, it was no more than 100 yards out, and went right past our stern. My God, I said, that was it. Suddenly it woke in my head, man, we were at war. You were almost gone at war. Because that thing hit us, we were gone. But it went right by, and fortunately it didn't hit any of the ship in the convoy. But for me, that said, this is serious, man. You better get on it and be more alert. And I grew up. I'm telling you, it scared the hell out of me. That's the only thing, as far as my personal being, that happened to me that I was aware of. Of course, scared, too. It was just something to remember. At another time, when the end of the day comes, the ships up anchor and go out of the harbor because we're that close to Japan and the Japanese bombers. We don't want to be in there anchored when they come in. So we get up and go out and circle around the island there until the next morning. So on the fourth day, we're out and we're coming back in. I had the midnight watch, it's 12 to 4 when we're cruising. And it was a little bit after 4 that I jumped on off the gun turret and get in my bunk. The next thing I know, bam! Holy macaroni. I'm in the second bunk up. There are three bunks, and I'm in the middle. And I wake up, and I'm standing next to on the deck next to my bunk. That thing, it jarred the ship. I said, holy mackerel, we're torpedoed. I turned around, and I look up to the port side, and there's a hunk of iron sticking through the night. I thought, man, it's a torpedo that didn't go off. I can't swim. And my life jacket is up on my gun turret where I left at 4 o'clock. And I first thing I think about, where's my life jacket? So I'm on the port side of the below decks. And when that thing happens and I'm standing there and I said, I got to get to my life jacket right now. So I got bizzling across to the starboard side of the ship to go up. There's a tubby guy right in front of me. And I just rather than say, I'm up there pushing his butt up. I said, get going, man. I got to get up to my life jacket. And I get up there and turn around. There's this other ship. It wasn't a ship. It was a ship's bow that was sticking through there. I thought it was a torpedo. But then I found out when I get up there, this other ship. And he had backed off and then come alongside again to keep us in balance, so we don't take a lot of crap till we get everything closed down below deck and get watertight, and we could float by ourselves. So they stand by us that long. But I'll never forget how I had to get that life jacket, because I thought we were going to sink. But, and then we get up, and that guy on the ship, on the other ship, even though they were responsible for it, they just forgot to turn when the other ships weren't coming in, and just pow, just like that. Mm-hmm. Scared the liver out of me.
Yeah, I read it put a pretty big hole in your hull. And how far was that from you, where the penetration happened?
I was below deck, and it came into our compartment.
So you're within feet of where bow of the other ship penetrated your hull.
It was about maybe from here out to the flowers out there.
So maybe 20, 30 feet, something like that?
Yeah, it wasn't too, it was big. There's a lot of metal showing it. I don't know why I thought it was I didn't concentrate on it that much. My mind was getting over this way and up on this to get my life jacket. That's number one. Yeah. Number two is what happened. And I thought it was a torpedo, you know, to come in like that, come through the side of the ship. But I didn't realize it was a bow of another ship until I got up on top, up on the main deck, and I could see it. So then I had to say, well, it wasn't a torpedo. Whew, thank heavens.
The late Bob McAvoy, another sterling representation of a generation that's been called the greatest, not because any of them tried to puff themselves up, but because so many were willing to selflessly serve and sacrifice. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today, throughout 2025, and for some of you, over the last two decades. I'm Paul Leffler, wishing you the happiest of New Year's and hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.